Good morning, everybody. I'm Bill Sanders, and I'm an alcoholic. And by the grace of a loving God, I'm sober today. And that will be the single most important thing that I can tell you, is it is by the grace of God that I'm sober and happy and joyous and free today. At times in my story, I tend to every once in a while start taking credit for some of my sobriety, so I need to tell you that other part up front. It is, I think, a miracle. Not that I did not take a drink today, but that I didn't want to. It's been a lot of 24 hours since I have wanted to take a drink, and that is the miracle part of this whole thing. It's great to be back here with you in Texas. I'm like some of the other speakers this weekend. It's great to be alive and anywhere, but to be invited back somewhere. This is, I think, my fourth time to be asked back to Texas. I almost don't count the first one. As I said the other night at the Meet the Speaker meeting, when I first was invited to come out here, I was invited to speak to the Texas Men's Workshop. It met in Ardmore, Oklahoma. I wondered if y'all were that bad that they wouldn't let you meet in Texas, or what the problem was. But it is great to be here this weekend. I too, as the other speakers have, want to thank the committee, all of those people who have made this weekend so wonderful. I've got to go home making amends to our buddy Pat, who moved to Atlanta and to our home group from Tyler. He has talked about Tyler AA until everybody in our home group is almost nauseated about it. And we were all in general agreement that it couldn't possibly be that good. I got to go home and make an amends. It is that good. Y'all are the friendliest, most wonderful people I've found anywhere, and we thank you from the bottom of our hearts for making us feel so much at home. Give yourself a hand. And as always, the new friends, a wonderful part of making trips like this. This sweet lady sitting on the front row, I was thinking last night, we were chatting going back to the hotel with Peggy. You know, nobody out there in that world is going to understand when you tell them that in less than 24 hours, you've come to know somebody and to love somebody as though you had known them all of your life. You know, they don't do things like that out there. We are so lucky. My sponsor used to look at me and say, you know, Bill, we're a part of something really, really big. And I said, yeah, I know it. I understand we're in 114 countries now. And he said, no, that's not what I'm talking about. Big, powerful. And we are. We need to hold on. I was like Peggy. When I made my list as a kid of the things that I wanted to be a part of when I grew up, AA was not in the hot 100. Never did I have any idea that I wanted to become a drunk. Never did I have an idea that I wanted to become a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I came to this fellowship, I declared that I had been drinking alcoholically and had been an alcoholic for about 2 or 2.5 years. You know, there's a funny thing. The longer I'm here, the further back that goes. And I realize today that Bill Sanders was born an alcoholic. At the age of 14, I became a drunk. And it took until I was almost 40 to become just an alcoholic again. I was almost 15 years old before I took my first drink of alcohol. But I've got to go in my life back further than that. I've got to go back to as a child growing up in a little town in North Georgia. I mean little, real little. You know, we used to say on Saturday night in Hartwell, Georgia, there were only two things you could do on Saturday night. Well, actually, three things. You could watch them unload the truck at the A&P. You could watch the water tank leak. Or you could go across the state line into South Carolina and buy some beer. Now, I did not come to you folks from watching too much water tank leaking. But before I ever had that first drink of alcohol on a trip over into South Carolina, I was different. I thought it was. I was afraid of people. Inside of me was a terrified little kid that wanted so very much to be accepted, but had no idea how. My mom would send me to the store to get something, and I was so terrified of talking with people that I would walk around all over an entire huge grocery store looking for something rather than stop somebody and ask them where it was because of a fear of rejection. I don't know what I thought they were going to say. Hell no, I ain't going to tell you where the bacon is. I don't know. But that scared little boy lived that way for a long time. But when I was not quite 15 years old, a group of friends said, come on, let's go to South Carolina and get some beer. A little lump caught in my throat. Said, sure. We got in the car, crossed over the state line into South Carolina and got a case of beer, came back and sat on the banks of the Savannah River, and I had my first taste of beer. Most god-awful stuff I had ever put in my mouth. I choked, I gagged, I sputtered, and I got it down. Only drank six that night. Peggy, I wish you'd have been there because I became Clark Gable. My Clark and your Marilyn, boy, we'd have had a ball. All the fear went away. Taste was terrible. You know, the truth of the matter is, I don't think booze ever really tasted all that good to me. I thought it did later on. But that taste is not what I drank beer for. Taste is not what I drank booze for. I drank for the effect. You know, I hear somebody every once in a while, I'll be somewhere there's some drinking going on, and somebody will offer somebody the second drink, and they say, no, I'm starting to begin to feel a little bit tipsy. I don't think I better have any. What? That's where I started. I used to go and sit in the bar and get four shooters down so I could get the buzz going. Then I'd get down to serious drinking. I don't understand those people that do it that way. I got drunk the first time I ever drank. I think I got drunk every other time that I drank until I came to you people. I don't really remember. There are a lot of in-between years there that I kind of lost along the way. But I like what the effect was, because that scared little boy went to sleep. And this one was a lot of bravado about him, and this one was a lot of savoir faire and all those other fancy words came alive. But the next morning, the little boy came out again. And I couldn't wait to get some more in to bring. And it became a cycle that I now know today is called alcoholism. I didn't drink that much other than beer. I didn't, matter of fact, not anything till beer until I went off to college. When I got to college, I was introduced to liquor. And it was quicker. I drank a lot in college because I got all of a sudden a taste of anonymity because the population of the University of Georgia at that time was about twice the population of my whole hometown. And there wasn't anybody there that cared how much Bill drank. So I started drinking every day. I was a social drinker, of course. You understand that. I've had to revise that definition because I now believe with all my heart that if you've got to drink in order to be social, you are not a social drinker. And that's what I had to do. But that's the only way I could put that scared little boy to sleep. I drank away a lot of my college career. Everybody talks about their grand and wonderful memories of college. I don't really have all that many because I stayed drunk most of it. Some of the memories I've got, I wish I didn't have. I found out some things about the university that I didn't like at all. They had no sense of humor. I ended up in the dean's office so many times that they had a little bench right out in front of Dean Tate's office, the dean of men. It was the Bill Sanders bench, because I sat on it more than anybody else did. I'd walk in his secretary, look up and say, Billy, be waiting a minute. You here again? You know, things that I shouldn't have been hauled in there for. Like, you won't believe this, I was almost thrown out of the university one time for singing the Star Spangled Banner in the middle of the night to an empty flagpole in front of the infirmary full of sick people. No sense of humor. No patriotism. The list of... That's all right, I'll wait. I came all the way from Georgia. The list goes on and on and on and on. Somehow I did manage to make it through the University of Georgia. And in my senior year at the university, Like Peggy's husband, I was in broadcasting. I'd gone into the broadcasting field as a kid in high school when I was actually just 13 years old, and that's all I'd ever known. And at the end of my junior year at the university, I was given the dream that every student of the communication school had, and that was an internship at the big 50,000-watt clear channel Voice of the South, WSB, in Atlanta. Oh, I dreamed of that, and I got it. As fate would have it, my roommate and I both got the two internships at that station that summer. In the spring of that year, Wayne and I came down to Atlanta, and we found us an apartment to live in, and we went by the station and met the people we were to work with, and we met the people who would be our superiors at the station and got our brief orientation, and I was on top of the world. Wayne and I decided to have a few drinks to celebrate before we went back to Athens, and he had 2 or 3, and I had 2 or 10, and we started back over the 60-mile trip back to the University of Georgia in Athens, and in the car we had borrowed for a friend, and my life couldn't have been better. And we got back to the friend's apartment and turned the car back over to him and decided to have a few more drinks to celebrate the greatest luck in the world that Wayne and I were sharing. And I got very drunk. And as I got drunk, I always did crazy, nutty, stupid, insane things. I know none of you did that, but I did. You know, there are motels and hotels I still can't go to today that frown on skinny dipping in their swimming pools. In case you come to Atlanta, I'll tell you right now, the Hyatt Regency Hotel in Atlanta don't like it when you go skinny dipping in their swimming pools, people looking down from their rooms up there. But we started climbing around in that room, and the fellow we were visiting with had an antique gun collection on the wall, and I took an old long barrel Colt pistol down off the wall and began waving around and acting like Matt Dillon. Pointed at my roommate and said, "Stick him up," and he threw his hands in mock surrender. And I pulled the trigger of a gun that hadn't been off the wall in years and years and years. In a moment, there was a sound like thunder, and my roommate lay on the floor in front of me in a pool of blood. A few hours later, that seemed like an eternity, at the Athens General Hospital, they would tell us that Wayne would live, but that he would never walk again. The bullet from the gun that was held in my hand had severed his spine, and he was paralyzed for life. The magic of that day crumbled down around me in an instant, as of course for him. A strange thing happened that night in a hospital room. From a bed, my roommate looked up at me, and he took my hand and he said, "Bill, it's okay. I know you didn't mean to do it. I know it was an accident. It could have just easily been me. Don't blame yourself." He forgave me, but I did not forgive me for more than 20 years. I didn't know how to forgive me until you people taught me how. And through the magic and power of those steps, that I was able to put that to rest. But not then. Then I used it as an excuse to crawl into a bottle. I came on to Atlanta that summer. Wayne came too. He spent the summer in hospital with surgery after surgery in futile attempt to restore use of his legs. I went to work at the station every day. I went to work at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, went on the air, did my program, came off, worked on until 11:30, and when I got off the 11 o'clock news at 11:30 at night, I'd cross the street to a bar, go in and drink myself into a stupor until 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, go stumbling out into a cab, go home, get up at 2 o'clock and go back and repeat the same cycle. Absolute, total alcoholism in full bloom, but I didn't know it. I remember very little about that summer. That's all I meant, Andrew, and I was a functional drunk. I was functioning, I was moving, but I didn't know what I was doing. Enjoying life? No. Magic, wonderful summer of that internship? No. That fall back in school, everything kind of came down to a slowdown after the summer of work. And I devised a plan. It was a good plan. It took me weeks to set it all up. I began to go to the infirmary, and they had 4 doctors in the infirmary, and I would visit them on alternating days. And I'd tell them how I was having trouble sleeping. And back then, I hope it's not that way today, back then they'd write you out a prescription for anything. That's where I first learned about Librium and all of those other things that came along before Vidium. But I would write, get the prescriptions for sleeping pills, and I'd go into the infirmary dispensary or pharmacy and get them, go back to the room, and I poured them all into a little bottle. And I did that for several weeks. And then I waited until a Friday afternoon when my new roommate was headed home for the weekend, and I watched him from the dormitory window as he got into his car and he pulled out onto the street and headed away. And I walked over and I locked the door, and I pulled down the shade in the room and pulled the curtains closed. I dumped all those pills out on the nightstand between our beds, and one by one, two by two, three by three, popped them into my mouth and swallowed them down. Turned out the light and pulled up the covers. And you know, folks, for over 20 years, I thought it was a great, big, huge coincidence that my college roommate's car broke down at the city limits of Athens and had to be towed back. And that he came into that room and found me there and the bottle on the nightstand and the deep sleep, and he knew something was wrong and had me hauled to the hospital and pumped out. I thought it was a big coincidence. I don't believe in coincidences anymore. I love the definition I've heard, that a coincidence is a miracle in which God chooses to remain anonymous. And that was an anonymous miracle in my life for a lot of years. I know today that it was God's way of saying, big boy, I ain't through with you yet. And I don't know today, with all the days, the many times I drove drunk, the cars I wrecked, the other insane things that I did, I don't know why Bill Thunders is alive today. I'm very grateful to be. But I figure if I keep showing up along the way, God's going to tell me why I'm here. And maybe he is today. I don't know. I'm having too much fun to worry about it anymore. But after that incident, I began my first sojourn with shrinks. I got a list of them a mile long. Paid them all and damned them all. They didn't help me a bit. Could have had something to do with the fact that I never told a single one of them the truth about much of anything, least and most of all about my drinking. Second, third, fourth question. Invariably and inevitably, did every one of those doctors, Bill, do you think you might have a drinking problem? Problem? No. I'm a social drinker. I just drink a few at a time. But I didn't tell them that part. Any of you ever read the book, The Three Faces of Eve? There are two great doctors from Augusta, Georgia that were involved in that case. One of them was involved in my case. He had a lot better luck with her than he did with me. They said she had three personalities. I'd have settled for three. Peggy told me there was meetings going on and talking in the head and all that. I had conventions in here. Still do sometimes. After college, I worked for a while in Atlanta and inevitably and eventually ended up in a little town in North Georgia, in Gainesville, Georgia. And went to work in radio there. Now, I was an early morning sign-on man, came on to be the one to be cheerful and happy and all that early in the morning. That's tough sometimes when your head is coming off your shoulders and you're trying to sound cheerful. You know, some of you people, you walk in your office in the morning, how you doing? Can't do that when you got a million people out there listening, expecting you to be happy, joyous, and free when you ain't got no touch with none of the above. Met a beautiful girl and fell in love. And everybody thought it would be a great idea if Bill got married. Because I think a lot of people had an idea that a good woman could get Bill sober. I identified when the movie Arthur came out, and the line was used in there that a good woman could get him sober, and he said, yeah, it took a real big woman. Well, the one I married wasn't that big. What's more, she liked to drink just about as much as I did. We made a great team. We went to the club every afternoon about 5 o'clock, and we stayed there until they closed. And then get home at 1 or 1:30 in the morning, I'd get up at 5:30, stumble in, go on the air. And it was in those days that I learned to pray. I'd drape myself over the microphone and say, dear God,
Thank you that this isn't television.
My wife became pregnant. We decided to straighten up, fly right, drink less. And we did, several weeks after the baby was born. And then we just added to our costs by having a babysitter to stay with the baby while we went to the club every night and drank ourselves into oblivion. The alcoholism was progressing then far, far more than either of us knew. Our marriage began to be in serious trouble. We would battle, we would fight, we would scream, we would yell. I'm sure the neighbors all knew all of our business. And I began to do things that we alcoholics tend to do sometimes, like, if I got any clue that I might be losing an argument, I terminated it right there. That's it. No more. Grab my bottle, jump in the car, take off. History. Well, I did that one Sunday afternoon. My wife had just about enough. I grabbed my bottle, stormed out of the house, got in the car, took off up the street about 60 miles an hour. Only thing wrong that day is I had to do that in my pajamas. Well, my wife did what any sweet, loving, caring, sharing wife would do. Now, this was my first wife I'm talking about. She called a friend to go get me and bring me home. Downside of that is that friend happened to be a police captain. And he found me sitting in the Holiday Inn parking lot talking to my bottle. And he suggested I get in the car with him. I suggested he could do the same thing with his car that Cease did that battleship. He suggested that I had forgotten that he was an ex-Marine, that he was considerably bigger than me. And the more he talked, even through the drunken stupor, his suggestion started to make sense. And so I got in the car with him, and he was going to take me home. I knew in about two turns that we weren't going home. Now, I got to jump forward all the way to the time I came in this program and tell you folks something. When I got here, and I was suggested to me when I sit down and write a fourth step, I said to my sponsor, very mistakenly, I don't really need to write that stuff down. I lived it. I got it right here. Let's just get on to this number five. Well, there are a lot of ladies here, so I'm not going to give you the exact wording he used, but he said, no, Bill, I think it would be a real good idea if you wrote it. Anybody that ever knew my sponsor, he's never that polite to anybody. He said, because there's something about us drunks makes us get honest when we have to start writing. Well, for the first time in over 15 years, I realized a lie that I had been telling all those years and even the first couple of years of my sobriety. And that was, I said, a lot of you people had been put in those hospitals and treatment centers for your drinking. That never happened to me. You see, I had a list of I nevers when I got here, and that was one of them. But that was a lie, folks. And I'm going to tell you how it happened and how it took me until I wrote down a fourth step for it to come alive in this sick, feeble brain. When Captain Harrell got me in his car, he started making those turns. Like I said, I knew we weren't going home. About three more minutes, we pulled up at the emergency room of the hospital. Into the back door with him on my arm, more like dangling from his arm. And in about 3 minutes, I was checked into the hospital. Don't take long when you already got your pajamas on. You know, they can whip you in that sucker in a hurry. Now, here's where my denial magically all came together. There got to be a little group meeting between my policeman friend, my wife, the doctor, and I don't know who else was involved in it. Maybe a shrink, I don't know. And they said, Bill is somewhat of a celebrity in town, and everybody knows who he is, and if we put him down there in detox, the newspaper is going to love to get it and put it on the front page. You know, I didn't even work for the paper, Patty, but they were ready to write. They'd have been wrote me up just like that. So they had a little group conscience and decided to put me over in the other part of the hospital, and they put a clipboard on the door that said I was in there for strep throat. And I stayed in there for a couple of weeks with strep throat. And when I walked out of there, I had been cured of strep throat. And I thought I had and believed that I had until I had to write a fourth step. And that's the honest truth. I conned myself so well that I denied why I was really there. I had all kinds of clues that I had a problem, and that was about number 19, but I didn't hear it. A few years later, my wife and I had made a geographical cure and moved back to Atlanta. And I got involved in a part of the broadcasting business that involved something called public relations. Now, if you don't know what public relations is, it involves a whole bunch of stuff, but first and foremost in my mind was a lot of drinking. Because you took people to lunch, and you took people to dinner, and you took people to cocktail parties, and when there wasn't a cocktail party, you planned one. And I was always the first there and the last to leave. And my drinking progressed and progressed and progressed. When I got to this fellowship, I always bragged about the fact that I only had one DUI. I think out here you call them DWIs, which confused the heck out of me. In Georgia, DUI means driving under the influence. When y'all said DWI, I thought you meant driving without influence. That didn't make sense. I sure didn't have any influence when I was out there driving, and nobody had any influence on me. But I got one DUI. But folks, I drove drunk every single day. I just got caught once. The time I got caught was when I proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that a 1976 Oldsmobile will not climb a steel post anchored in concrete. In case you need to experiment on that, I've done it for you. It won't work. My little girl was beginning to grow up, 4, 5, 6 years old, and I don't remember much about those years. I know she avoided Daddy a lot. I think I was vaguely aware of that. I went to the bars every afternoon after work, and I'd get home at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and then later on I'd get home sometimes the next morning and sometimes not. My moral behavior became worse and worse. I woke up in strange beds with strange people. The unmanageability of my life was right there, like a drive-in theater screen, but I couldn't see it. My wife was out drinking. Sometimes we drank together. If the battle lines were drawn strong enough, she drank one place and I drank somewhere else. And by this time, there was a little girl home alone. At 7 and 8 years old, she was calling bars, asking, "Is my mommy there? Is my daddy there?" Sometimes we were, and I'd get on, "Yeah, honey, I'm just going to have one more, and I'll be home. Now, just don't call here anymore now. This is a busy place. Don't. Please, Daddy, come home." 3 or 4 hours later, I'd go home, and she sometimes would be asleep on the sofa, sometimes curled up in her little bed with the covers drawn up around her head, and I knew she was afraid. Did it stop me? No. See, I'm an alcoholic. I only thought of me. It progressed and progressed, and the behavior got worse and worse. The marriage crumbled more and more. And I even got to the point, well, first wife of mine, where I didn't like drinking with her. She wasn't fun anymore. All we ever did was fight. I always said I never drank alone, so I knew I couldn't be an alcoholic. Toward the end, I drank alone, I drank together, I drank with you, I drank at you. And one night, a very strange thing happened. My wife walked out of the house and left, and I was sitting there in the living room, my recliner chair with my bottle of booze in my hand. It wasn't strange if she left. She left all the time. I didn't care where she was going. 2 or 3 hours later, she came walking back in the house and stood in front of me. I'm still in that same chair. And she looked down at me and she said, "Guess where I've been?" And I said, who cares? And she did the weirdest thing. She didn't say anything. She flipped a white poker chip into my lap. And I looked down at it, and I looked up at her, and I looked down at it, and I looked back up at her, and I said, "I don't know where you've been, but if that's all you won, you had a lousy night." Well, you people know where she'd been. Now, I'm going to backtrack about 3 years. About 3 years before that, my wife went to an Al-Anon meeting to find out what to do about that fellow at home. The only thing wrong with that picture is she went to the Al-Anon meeting crocked. They suggested to her that she might be in the wrong room. That ticked her off, so she left for 3 years. Well, that night, she had wandered back into an AA meeting, and it picked up a white chip. Well, she was to have some hell in front of her, but she started going to meetings every single day. They told her 90 and 90, she did it, and then some. To her credit, I must say, she did not come home and preach at me. She did not come home and yell at me. She did not come home and say, you are and you better, and if you don't, she didn't do that. There were little clues around, like I go in the bathroom, lift the toilet seat, and there's How It Works taped up there, you know. I mean, she knew me pretty well. She knew I'd see things. You're worshiping at the porcelain throne, you know. You go under my pillow, be that little pamphlet, had those questions in it, and I answered about 9 of them yes and threw the thing away. But she never said anything about going to the meetings until one day. She said, I know I never asked you to go to an AA meeting before. Oh, I said, oh, hell, here it comes. She said, I'm going to get a 90-day chip tonight. Would you go with me? Mm-mm, no. Please, back and forth, back and forth. Never ask you to go again. Aha. Get it in writing. I said, I'll go on one condition. I go in my car. Fine. So we drove a couple of miles to the little meeting place called the 8111 Club. It's a little house. Been turned into a... Used to be a house of prostitution. Oh, appropriateness of that, but it's now an AA clubhouse. And I walked in, folks, and sat down right at the back of the room next to some sliding glass doors. And for the next hour, I witnessed the nuttiest, craziest bunch of people I had ever seen in my life. There was a guy in that room, raised his hand after they went through all this file wall at the opening. And he said, you know, my name's so-and-so, and I'm an alcoholic. And I got 2 DUIs before I got here, and everybody cracked up laughing. Jeez. Another guy over here said, ain't nothing. I had 7. What's more, I got arrested for indecent exposure, and I got away, and everybody just cracked up and just roared. And I got to thinking, I said, you know, if they heard some stuff I'd do, I could sound like Richard Pryor in here. But the thing that struck me the most in that meeting, and the only thing I really remembered, was, don't these people know what they are? They don't have anything to laugh about. Oh, God, what a wonderful gift we've got, that gift of laughter. I agree with what Peggy said. You know, I think God put a little bit of stupid in every one of us, something that we can look at about ourselves and that we can laugh about. And we people in Alcoholics Anonymous have learned to look at those things and to look back at those crazy tragedies in our own lives and to laugh about them more than anybody else in the world. AA gives you a sense of humor if you hadn't got one when you get here. And if you don't have one when you get here, you better get one. You're going to be in trouble. But I listened to those people, and at the end of that hour, everybody stood up, and I started to the door, and somebody grabbed my hand from each side, and I went, oh, God. And they said the only thing that I recognized in that whole hour I was in there, and it was the Lord's Prayer. And they got through with that, and I started out of there. Man, I was getting out of this place. My wife got her chip. I saw her get the chip. She saw me see her get the chip. I'm history. Let's go. And I started out across this old dirt parking lot, and I got about halfway to my car, and this suddenly felt like a steel vice grabbed me by the shoulder and spun me around, and I found myself looking up into the face of a fellow who appeared to be 7 feet 8 inches tall. I know today he's only 6'6 or 6'7, but he looked a lot taller. I had remembered him from the meeting, because he had identified himself differently from everybody else in the room. Everybody else had said, my name's Mike, and I'm an alcoholic, and my name's Scott, and I'm an alcoholic, my name's Joe, and I'm an alcoholic. That guy said, my name's Floyd, and I'm a grateful hillbilly drunk. I said, give me a break. This guy's not for real. And here he is. And I'm staring up at this big, black-headed, good-looking guy, and he's starting to talk to me. And I'm going, oh, God. And he starts talking to me about drinking moonshine out of mason jars, and in the wintertime falling down out in the woods, and his face freezing to the ground. Now, people, I drank at the Diplomat. I spent my time in hospitality suites. I didn't, you know, just give me a break. Well, he talked and he talked and he talked, and people came out and got in their cars and left. Remember, I went in my own car so I could get away. My wife comes out, smiles, goes, bye, gets in her car and leaves. And it's me and Floyd. I get to my car, reach for the door handle, he leans against it. He talks for what seems like an hour. I finally got in my car, went home as fast as I could go, walked into the house. My wife went. I said, don't open your mouth. I went to the refrigerator in the cabinet, grabbed an iced tea tumbler that high, put three ice cubes in it, and filled it with vodka. And I said, we'll get through with this. We'll talk. Of course, when I got through with that, I couldn't talk. But I made the decision then and there. Never again. Not me. You ain't getting me in one of those meetings. Much less that guy. I will jump ahead and tell you something. One of the greatest thrills of my life was for his 7th and 8th birthday. After that, Floyd asked me to give him his chip. I love him to this day, and I'll tell you why in a minute. My drinking continued. My misbehavior continued. I did crazy things that did not fit with the image I had of myself as the social public relations drinker. You know, it is hard to be cool when you wake up on the ground in a city park staring at the nostrils of a policeman's horse. Good morning, Hausdorfer. That ain't cool. I don't care how much public relations training you had, you can't pull that off. And everything's worse than that. On the afternoon of July 26, 1982, I came out of a week-long blackout drunk. And when I came out of that drunk, I was sitting in that same recliner chair in our living room. And I looked down, and there was an empty vodka bottle in my left hand, and there was a cocked .22 pistol in my right hand. And the thought going through my mind was, is this all there is? Is this really all there is? And through the fog of that moment, there came back to me one line from an old Grateful Hillbilly drunk. And the only thing I remember that that big old drunk said to me that night in that parking lot was, when I come to AA, I expected God to open up the gates of heaven and let me in. He didn't. But he opened the gates of hell and let me out. When I came to AA, I expected God to open up the gates of heaven and let me in. He didn't. But he sure opened the gates of hell and let me out. And if where I was that Monday afternoon, sitting there with that pistol in that bottle, if I wasn't at the gates of hell, I don't know where I was. And if there is a hell worse than that, I don't want to know about it. And I got into my car and I drove a couple of miles back to the little 8111 club. And I walked in that same room and I sat down in the back of that room at that door. I sat carefully behind the post so the people sitting up at that table at the front couldn't see me. I peeked around the post. There, sitting at the table, was my wife, chairing the meeting. Tell me God ain't got a sense of humor. Of course, what I didn't know is the divorce papers were already drawn up. I looked my daughter in the face in so long I couldn't remember when. I hadn't even noticed that she didn't invite friends over to spend the night anymore, because she didn't know when Dad was going to come home in one of his drunken rages, throwing things, smashing television sets, breaking windows, tearing up furniture. I didn't even notice. I didn't even notice that the only look that was ever in her eyes was one of fear and disgust and, yes, even hate. I was too busy with me. I didn't know the marriage was over. But it was. But at the end of that meeting, all I knew is that I had nowhere else to go. And I took the longest walk I've ever taken in my life, from the back of that room to the front of that room. And a man put a white chip in my hand and closed it on it and put his arms around me and hugged me. I don't remember anything that was said in that meeting. I don't remember anything that I saw about meetings except my wife sitting up there with her mouth hanging open. But all I do know is that when I walked from the front of that room back to my seat, for the first time in a long, long time, I felt hope. That's all. No revelation. No, I know it's going to be okay. No, this is it. It's going to work now. None of that. Just hope. Because you see, I'd run out of it. Nothing worked anymore. I could high roll it, big deal it enough to make it all work inside for a long time. And if I stayed in the whirlwind, I stayed in the middle, I stayed in the high rolling crowd, went to the governor's mansion and did all these other wild and crazy things that were high society and all that, I could make it work. But after a while, it didn't work. Nothing worked. I was down to that horrible black ooey gooey mess inside of that golf ball. I didn't like what was in there, and I couldn't find anything else. That night, I felt hope. They told me right off I ought to get a sponsor. And I looked around and I found the sweetest, kindest, roly-poliest, white-haired man that I could possibly find that looked just like my late granddaddy. And I said, there's the one. He will pat me on the head. He will tell me I'm a good boy. He will love me. And he will just, you know, perfect. Worst mistake I ever made in my life. I asked a man named Doc Crandall to be my sponsor. In the years he was my sponsor, I don't remember him ever telling me one damn thing that I wanted to hear. He told me a whole lot of what I needed to hear. First thing he told me was, he said, fine, I'm going to be your sponsor. First thing you do every morning, not the second thing, first thing, you get down on your knees and you ask God to keep you sober today. Well, let's see, Doc, I've kind of gotten a long way away from religion. I'm not real comfortable with this knee business, but I can pray. There's no problem about that. I can pray. He said, I didn't say anything about you being comfortable. Get down there. But this is a program of suggestion. It is. I suggest you do it or get you another sponsor. That's how we started. And it went downhill from there. He pointed up the wall and said, see those 12 suggestions on the wall? Yes, sir. Good news is they are just 12 suggestions. Bad news, there ain't no other suggestions. That's it. Get to work. He told me a lot of things. Doc said, if you get an argument in your head about whether or not you don't take a drink, you're going to lose. You can't win that argument. It's got to not be a topic for those meetings that go on in your head. Well, I understand that. That makes sense. I heard it, but I didn't hear it. Been sober about 3 months. Went on my first business trip up to your hometown up in Washington, D.C., Peggy. Plane hadn't cleared the ground, Hartsfield International Airport in Atlanta, till the meeting started in my head. Call to order. Will Bill drink or not in Washington? Yes. He is 800 miles from home. No one up there knows he's in AA. Certainly he can tie one on for a couple of days. You know, I didn't say have a drink. I have never wanted a drink. I see no point in having a drink. I think there's something wrong with a person who has a drink. I go in a restaurant today and I watch a fellow order a drink, polish off two-thirds of it before he finishes his lunch, start to leave. I want to chase him out into the parking lot and say, get back in there and finish that thing. Crazy people. You want to drink? Drink. But that meeting went on in my head all the way to Washington. Touched down at National Airport. Got in the cab, headed to National Airport, to the Hyatt Regency Hotel on Capitol Hill. The meeting, yes, no, 800 miles. Nobody will know. By the time you get home Friday, forgot everything Doc said. Walked into that hotel lobby. Now, you know, people, we've got radar. That is a huge atrium lobby with all kinds of stuff. Radar found a bar right over the corner. I can hear the music. Nobody else could, I'm sure. I could hear the tinkling glass.
This is the end of side one. Please turn the cassette over and continue to play on the other side.
Oh, yeah.
I went up to my room, dumped my luggage, came back downstairs, walked to the door of the bar, and stood there while the meeting was continuing to go on in my head. I was waiting for a vote. And the vote came after I'd stood in that door about 3 minutes, and the vote was
drink.
And I walked over to the bar and I sat down. The bartender walked and stood in front of me. And he looked at me and he says, "Hi, fella, how about a Coke?" I said, "What?" He said, "I figured by that lapel pin you're wearing, that's probably what you'd want." I had forgotten to take off this damn AA pin. Coincidence that I got a bartender in AA? No. He set that Coke down. I sat there staring at that sucker. And didn't touch it. He goes down, serves a couple of other people, stands and comes back right in front of me and looks at me. I said, "You ain't got any business in here, have you?" "Huh?" He said, "Where you belong is two blocks down the street, upstairs. There's a meeting in 20 minutes. Get the hell out of here." That night in a hotel room in Washington, D.C., I ended up on my knees beside a bed, and I said, "God, if you went to that much trouble to keep this drunk sober, I will never test you that way again." And I stay out of bars. I don't have any business in bars. I don't have any business going places that tempt me. If I do have business to meet someone where booze is served, if I've got a good reason to be there, I know I've got a good reason to be there. I get my business done, and I get out. But I can't con me anymore. I can't say it's okay for me to go sit between two drunks and drink a Coke. I used to think that when I first came to the program. Those are my buddies. Those are my friends. Those are my pals. I can't abandon them. I mean, I drank with those people for years. I'm going to tell you something, people. I walked in a bar about 2 years ago. It was a restaurant that had a lounge next to it, and I was meeting somebody for lunch in the restaurant. I looked down, and you had to kind of look down into the bar to see down a few steps, and I saw a guy down there, a banker, that I had drank next to for several years, sitting at the bar, drinking his lunch. I said, "I'm going to go down there and say hi to old Lynn. Good God, I hadn't seen him in 6 years. I walked down there, walked up to him, put my hand on his back. He turned around. "Hey, boy, you been out of town?" 6 years! Let me tell you something. I've been gone for that bar 6 years. Not one of those dear bosom buddy close friends has written. Not one of them has called. Nobody has checked up to see where I was. I figured it out. Most of them didn't even know I was gone. I missed my home group, Mount Vernon group in North Atlanta, one night. And the phone's ringing. "Where are you? You okay? Where's Marlene? Where's Scott? We just want to make sure you're all right." Those people love me and they care. I never had one single bartender say, "You keep coming back and it'll get better." Not one. But you people did. Doc told me one night after a meeting, actually it was the beginning of a meeting, he said, "Tonight there's a fellow here that's got a story similar to yours, a similar background. I want you to stay after the meeting and chat with him a little bit." I said, "Doc, I tell you, I really would love to, but I got a headache. I had a day like today you would not believe. I am starving to death. Didn't have time to get about before I came to the meeting tonight. And I really would love to, but maybe another time." He said, "You don't understand." I said, "You're going to stay at the meeting and talk with this guy. We're going to sit down right there in the front room. We're going to talk." "All right." 15 minutes. That's it. I got to go. See, I didn't trust you people. I'd been here for several months. All these miracles happened. I still didn't trust you. I didn't know what your catch was. I figured there was another book you'd give me a little bit later on, so here's the inside dope. I didn't know what your angle was. What were you getting out of this? You're so nice to me. Hopefully I'll catch on one of these nights. Well, what happened that night? That meeting was over at 9 o'clock. Bach and I and this fellow slipped into that front room. We sat down and started talking. 2.5 hours at 11:30, I walked out of that meeting place. Actually, I kind of floated out. The headache was gone. I forgot about being hungry. I wasn't mad at anybody anymore. And I ended up pulling off the side of the road on my way home with my face down on the steering wheel, tears pouring down my face, because suddenly I knew what your angle was. You got out of yourself and into action with this drunk, and that night I was allowed to get out of this self-centered, egocentric lunatic and to reach out to somebody else. Dear God, did it feel good. Now, out of that one incident that night, I have developed a theory of how to be successful and happy and joyous and free in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you haven't figured it out, I'm going to tell you what it is. Tonight, you go home and you write down what you perceive your debt to AA to be. And then one day at a time, you try to pay it back. And you're going to be happier than you've ever been happy in your life. Because this is the one time in a talk when I do take other people's inventory. I'm going to tell you today that if you're not happier than you've ever been in your life, then you've got a hole in your program somewhere. Because you're supposed to be happy, joyous, and free. And I believe that with all my heart. You know, I laugh more than I've ever laughed in my life. I have learned in AA, you don't laugh all the time or they'll come get you. Everything has not been wonderful in sobriety. We've had tragedy in our lives. A year and a couple of months ago, our beautiful daughter, 19 years old, was taken to a hospital. And for 3 days, doctors, she teetered it between life and death. Raging fever packed in ice while the doctors tried to determine what was wrong. If we had not had this program, if we had not had these people, you people, I don't think we would have made it. I learned the power of saying, God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. And I learned from a dear lady that I love very much, my sponsor's wife, who said, you must say, thy will be done. Well, that little girl recovered. And I got to tell you something about her. I didn't know who she was. When I got sober, she was 12 years old. I knew what she looked like, and it was about it. One of the times that told me that this program was working was when I was about 6 months sober, and I was sitting in that same recliner chair, and that little girl crawled up in my lap. And she put her arms around my neck, and she says, Daddy, I love you, and I want to get to know you better. In these last 8.5 years, we have gotten to know each other better. Oh, God, she's my princess, and I love her. And we have fun together. I also got to back up to about 6 months and tell you something. You know, I talked to you about my first wife. Well, the marriage between me and my first wife ended. She got sober, I got sober. And the old marriage died. And on the 30th of December of 1982, instead of signing divorce papers, that first wife of mine and me stood in front of the minister who had married her 16 years before, and surrounded by friends in this fellowship, we started over. We renewed those vows and we said we're going to do it right this time with God in our camp. And it works. And she's right here on the front row, and she's been on the front row with me for every thing in my life. You tell me you don't believe in miracles? I am one. So are you. I've been sober 3.5 years. When my sponsor Doc went on a 12-step call one morning in November of 1985 and never came home. He had a young fellow he'd been working with for several years, and he and another man had gone to talk with this young fellow and attempt to talk him out of a suicide. He had bounced in and out of the program many times. And in a struggle to take the gun away from this young fellow, Doc was shot in the stomach and died on the way to the hospital. And my world crashed down around me.
What can I do without Doc? How can I possibly stay sober without this man in my life? This towering giant, this white-headed, roly-poly man that I ill-chosen, but God, I know, had placed in my life. But another miracle happened. The guys that I was fortunate enough to sponsor surrounded me, and they loved me, and they cared for me, and they carried me to meetings when I didn't want to go. They would not let me isolate. They helped me walk until I could walk again. And it was then that I learned and realized, how could I stay sober without Doc? By doing what my sponsor, he had taught me to do, and what his sponsor had shared with him, and his sponsor before him had shared with him, and his sponsor all the way back to when the broken down doctor and the defeated little stockbroker sat down in a gatehouse in 1935 and said, "Do you think we might be able to stay sober if we help another drunk?" My granddaddy's sponsor, God love him, year before last, died 9 days after his 40th birthday in this program, was fond of saying that he believes with every bit of fiber in him that in May or June of 1935, that God in his infinite wisdom looked down and said, "The lowly alcoholic has suffered long enough. I've got to give him a way out." And what a way he gave us. This granddaddy sponsor of mine, Bill, was also fond of saying, "It's still getting better every day." That, in Atlanta, at meetings, we read the promises that Cease read last night on page 83 and 84 of the big book. We read them at every meeting. And I added that to the bottom of the list of my promises. It's still getting better every day. Because you know what? I believe if we walked into these rooms and they say, "Here are the goodies, here's what you're going to get in sobriety," and they laid it out in front of us in a box, we take it out and go, "Oh, golly gee, wow," we'd enjoy it for a week, be bored stiff, and we'd be back out there. But we get a little bit as time goes along. We get a little more and a little more, and it gets better, and we get new friends and new people, and we go, and it just keeps getting better and better and better. I did my fifth step with that little man. He called himself the ugliest man in AA. His name was Bill Hollingsworth. He spoke around the country a lot. A lot of you may have heard him. I layered my first step in writing it. And the reason I did that is I had some stuff. You know, we all got some stuff that I put way down here at the bottom. And I was determined that when I got to the point in my talk with him during the fifth step, when he went, "Ooh," I was going to stop right there. I ain't going to tell him the rest. Today I know I didn't even get close. I laid it all out. I told him things that I had done and places that I had been and things in my life that I had never told another living soul. I was also grateful when I told him those that I knew I would never have to tell anybody again. So many of those things I've shared so many times with so many people, and you know what? They just ain't no big deal anymore. They're not nearly as dark and dirty and ugly as they once were. But when I got through doing that fifth step, that little man stood up, and he reached out, and he put his arms around my neck, and he hugged me, and he says, "I love you so much. And you know what? There's a bond between us that not even death can take away. Because we've shared each other with each other. And when one of us is gone, the other will still be here." And you know, that's what we are in AA. We are collectively all of those who have come before us. We've shared the experience, strength, and hope. Sometimes I get a little upset at people and they say, "Well, that's not in the big book." Well, there's a lot that's not in the big book. I've got a lot of people that say, if I go back out there, then I'm going to get drunk. And I'm not going to be able to drink successfully any more than any of those other thousands who have gone back out there. And you know, every time that thought has popped into my head, maybe I can handle it, some poor sucker comes walking back in going, "Oh God, no." I had a friend that I love very dearly. His name was Palmer. Palmer bounced in and out of this fellowship over and over and over again. God, Palmer loved to drink. He was a good old boy.
He comes shuffling back in after one of his three-week benders, and God, I sure am glad you people are here for me. I don't know what I'd do if y'all weren't here for me. Y'all just let me come back. And he had enough white chips, he could have made four necklaces out of them. One day, the call came to me. Palmer's in the hospital. Oh, boy. Palmer done it again. I went over to the hospital, went up to the alcohol and drug unit, asked the nurse what room Palmer's in. She told me. I started down the hall. She said, wait a minute. She said, I don't know if you want to go down there or not. I said, he's not going to know you. I said, why? She said, he's in an alcoholic coma. I went on down to that room and opened that door, and I walked in, and I never want to forget the sight I saw. But there on that bed was Palmer with a tube coming out of every opening that there was. His eyes looking but seeing nothing. And he lay there for 5 days. And he died. I sure am glad all you folks are always there for me when I come back in. I just mess up. But you see, Palmer never bargained for the day when he couldn't make it back. Then from the grave he 12-stepped this drunk. I had a friend in the program named Steve. Steve was a little bitty fellow with a little bony finger who was fond of punching air and said, this is serious business, people. This alcoholism is life and death stuff. He was sober several years and he had a relapse. And for 8 months he tried to put his program back together and he couldn't make it work. And he kept stumbling and falling and stumbling and falling. And one Saturday morning he walked out of a meeting, walked down the road from 8111 Club, and he walked into a shopping center, bought a gun, walked around behind the bank, put it in his mouth, and blew his head off. And this was before Doc had died, and I said to Doc, you know, Steve killed himself yesterday, Doc. I don't know if you heard that. He said, yeah. I said, yeah, he killed himself, self-inflicted gunshot wound. And Doc said, Bill, that's not what killed Steve. I said, yeah, it is. It's in the paper, Bill. Steve died from untreated alcoholism. Steve's been dead for a year. His body's dead now. And I could see that bony little finger punching the air saying, folks, this is serious business. This is life and death stuff. Doc told me, as I said, to work those steps. I want to tell you just very briefly what those steps mean to me. I love to call those steps my toolbox. I had a hard time with the steps. Doc would say to me, Bill, I'd go to him with some problem. Doc, this is going on at the office, and this is going on. Well, what step are you using on it? I said, Doc, this doesn't have anything to do with steps. This is real life stuff. This is business. I need to know. Go look in the steps. All right. I'd go, spend 5 minutes, come back. Doc, I'm telling you, this has nothing to do with it. Go look again. And through that old man, I came to realize that there is nothing that will happen in my life that the answer does not lie in that toolbox called the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Nothing. As I said, I had a hard time with those steps. I went when I first started studying, and I looked at Doc and I said, Doc, I've been reading these. I spent a couple hours last night. And looking at this first step, now, as I interpret, he stopped me right there. He says, Bill, those steps don't need your interpreting. They need your doing. Yeah, I know, Doc, but what I'm saying is, I understand, but what I understand that this means, he says, Bill, those steps are in English. They even put little numbers by them for smart college boys like you. And then that's when he jumped in on me about my other disease. I said, what other disease? He says, your damn terminal uniqueness. He says, you may be too smart to get sober. Well, that ticked me off just enough. And I started working through those steps. And in that first step, I was able to walk in and say, I'm beat. I'm broken down. I'm here because I got no place to go. My life is in shambles. Bill Wilson and our founders were very sneaky. They didn't say anything about me being nuts till the second step. They got me past the first one. They said, restore to sanity. I said, wait a minute, I didn't say anything about being insane. By then I was able to hear, oh yeah, you are. And then the third step, I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of. Now, that was carefully explained to me. It didn't say, give your life to God and walk off, and you stand there and watch and see what he does with it. It says, to the care of. And then that's when Doc said, start writing, and I argued and lost. And in the writing of that first step, I was able to go into the dark corners of the house of my life. And I was able to gather up the garbage that had caused the stench in my life for so long and bring it all together. Package it all up. And in the fifth step, I was able to bring all that garbage out of the house of my life onto the front porch and into the sunshine and there before God and another human being to sort it all out and to look at it and say, here, this is the sum total of where I've been. And then in step six, I had a decision to make. Am I going to take all that garbage back into the house again and spread it all around and tuck it back into those dark corners? Or am I willing for God to take it away? And step seven allowed me, for the first time in my life, to experience some humility to realize that I could not, in any shape, form, or fashion, remove that garbage from my life, but that God could, and all I had to do was to ask him. There were people I had hurt. That little girl, that wife, that employee, family, friends. And step eight allowed me to sit down and to write down all those people's names. And then step nine, to go back and to clear away the wreckage of the past with them and to say, I am truly sorry. Now, not all of them accepted them. I had one that didn't. And Doc said, Bill, it doesn't say anywhere in there that they will, and by God, accept those amends. He said, you've done your part, balls in their court. Key word in step 10 to me is continue. To continue to use those other nine tools on a daily basis, and when I'm wrong, first of all, admit to myself that I'm wrong, and then I'm able to say to you. In step 11, improve the conscious contact with God of my understanding. It didn't say that I'm going to know him better, understand him better, be able to analyze him, know his name, know what he looks like, know where he is. It says improve my conscious contact with him and to ask for what his will for my life is and to give me the power to carry it out. And then in step 12, it says go share what you got. And don't forget where it came from and keep practicing what those other 11 up to now have done. What a fantastic, beautiful box of tools. This program has been so good to me. 4 years ago on a late spring afternoon, I had a young fellow come over with a sponsoree to my house and do some work in my yard, and they were working out there, and I offered the young fellow a Coke. I said, come in the house and sit down, let's have a Coke and talk a minute. And he came in, and he was a punk if there ever was one, long hair down on his shoulders, grungy looking little. He asked me to be his sponsor. I said, no, I already sponsor. Your sponsor, that's close enough. He was persistent. I'll crunch through a whole lot of other stuff and tell you that a couple of years after that, he moved into our home, became a part of our family. He was the son that we never had. And he's right here on the front row today. And I love him. And when our little girl was in the hospital at death's door, she did recover fully, incidentally. And my wife was spending the night at the hospital. I don't know what I'd have done if Scott hadn't been there to tell me it'd be okay. You see, in this program, folks, I often wonder who's sponsoring who. Because the more you give, the more you get. That secret I was talking about, perceive what your debt to Alcoholics Anonymous is and then pay it back one day at a time. You won't ever even the debt up, folks. I'll tell you that right now. You won't get close. Because the more you give, the more you get back, and you end up deeper in debt, but richer. Now, I'm going to close. But Doc always told me that the only place to be in this fellowship is in the middle of the bed. He said, ain't nobody ever fell out of the middle of the bed. You hang around the edges, you're going to fall off. You're in the middle, you're going to be fine. Get in the middle of the bed and stay there. I'm going to share with you a true story. I used to tell this in third person, but I'm going to tell it like it really happened. On a very hot August day in 1969, I, as a young reporter, was covering a story for a network. It was a story about one of the most famous men in show business, in circus, by the name of Carl Willenda. You may have heard of the Fly of Willendas. He was coming to North Georgia to a little, well, a big gorge in North Georgia called Tallulah Gorge. Some of you may have heard of it. It's where, through millions of years, water has come down through and carved out of the rocks this gorge, 1,200 feet deep. Well, as a stunt car, well, Linda decided to come, stretch a cable across that gorge, and to walk that cable. And thousands gathered on the banks of that gorge on that August afternoon to watch. I was covering it for a network. And I stood there with a microphone, and I interviewed people in the crowd as the anticipation grew and as the excitement reached a fever pitch. And pretty soon, actually several hours after we waited and waited, Linda walks out of this trailer, dressed in all of his spangles and in all of his fancy finery, and he struts out through the crowd. Now, I'm convinced, and I said it on that network that day, that there are a lot of people who came there to watch that man fall in the gorge. You know, we like that. I had done my homework and research. I knew this guy. He was the greatest tightrope walker of all times. I had no idea that he would ever fall into that gorge at all. I was sure he wouldn't. He came through the crowd and was led over to where I was to do a brief interview before he started the walk. The crowd got very quiet. The only sound was the sound of the wind whistling down through that gigantic gorge. And a towering man stood in front of me, and I said, "Mr. Walinda, are you frightened?" He said, "Of course not." He said, "You know, there are a lot of people who think I'm going to fall into this gorge today and kill myself. Do you think I am?" I said, "No, sir, I don't. I have no doubt whatsoever. I've done my homework. I have done research on you. I've seen the feats you've done between towering skyscrapers across part of Grand Canyon. I have no doubt you can make this walk." He said, "Do you believe I can make that walk pushing by wheelbarrows propped up against that little trailer over there?" I said, "Yeah. I've seen you ride bicycles. I've seen you do all. I have no doubt whatsoever that you can make that walk successfully pushing that wheelbarrow." And then he asked this little reporter a question. He said, "Do you believe it enough to get in the wheelbarrow?" This program asks that you believe it enough to get in the wheelbarrow. We don't ask much, just change your life, change everything you go, where you go, who you see, how you think. But I'm going to tell you something, in that wheelbarrow out over that gorge is a beautiful view. Now wait a minute, don't get any wrong idea, I did not get in that wheelbarrow. I'm back to the figurative wheelbarrow of this program. It's scary. I hear people talk about blind faith. That's a redundancy, all faith is blind. If I can see around the next corner, I don't need faith. But there are times in my life when I've got to step off the curb in the dark. But you see, I don't do it alone. I have somebody on every side of me, holding me up, taking the walk with me. And I've got the magic and the power of those 12 steps to guide my life and to steer me back into the middle of the bed. I'm going to close with a very simple prayer. It's the prayer that I pray in the mornings when I drive by the Chattahoochee River on my way to work and watch the sun come up. And it's the same prayer I pray every year when I get another medallion for celebrating a year of sobriety. And it's the same prayer I pray when I look into my beautiful daughter's eyes today and I see love and respect instead of fear and hate. And it's the same prayer I pray when I put my arms around my wife and I say 3 or 4 or 5 times a day, "I love you," and I mean it from the bottom of my heart. And she looks back and says, "I love you." And it's the same prayer I pray for a son that I never had who's so important in my life and for all of the other sponsorees and sponsors that I have. And that prayer is very simply this. Dear God, thank you because I almost missed all this. Is that all there is? We ain't seen nothing yet. I love you all and thank you for your hospitality. You've been wonderful. God bless.